Hi, Suzanne. How are you? It's nice to talk with you on the phone today.
It's very nice of you to have invited me, Betsy. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. I just wanted to let you know that we're recording this call, and I'm looking forward to our conversation and learning much, much more about all the work that you do and have done to advocate for animals flying across our Great Lakes. So, if you would go ahead and introduce yourself and what it is you'd like to speak with us about today, that would be very helpful.
Okay, great. As you know, I'm Suzanne Albright, and I'm a lakeshore resident, but over here on Lake Ontario. And our home is in Greece, New York, which is a Rochester suburb. And I'm recently retired as a family nurse practitioner. I was a primary care provider here on the western side of Rochester primarily for about 40 years. That was
Wow.
my paid career.
Sure.
Having lived on the shore of this lake for over 35 years, I think I became really passionate about Lake Ontario and the Great Lakes in general. And also the amazing avian population, because we have a fairly substantial residential group of waterfowl and raptors, songbirds, but also we live on one of the most amazing migratory routes of North America, the whole south shore of Lake Ontario. It's a well-known migratory flyway, and that's for countless, not countless, but many, many varieties of raptor species, waterfowl, songbirds. And in fact, I'm a member and volunteer educator with Braddock Bay Raptor Research.
Okay.
And that's our local raptor organization.
Yes.
I think that you have learned a little bit about it since we first spoke.
I have, and I'm looking. Thank you for helping Western Cuyahoga Audubon Society here on the in Cuyahoga County in the Cleveland, Ohio area begin to learn about not only your efforts, which we're going to learn more about in our conversation, but also some of the other avian organizations in your area, in the greater Rochester area, and all the work that goes on in that section of the state. So, yes, I'm looking forward actually to speaking soon with, I believe it's the director that you connected me to.
Yes, Dana
Yeah,
Ford.
so, yes, exactly. Yeah, and I'm excited about that. There seems to be a very strong sense of collaboration coming out of your area of the southern shores there, and certainly something that we can all learn from, as well as all of the probably amazing amount of knowledge that everyone has there as you share your conversations. So, but I got a question for you. So, are you from that area, the Rochester area originally, or where are you from?
Well, basically, I mean, we moved up here from the Washington, D.C. area when I was
Oh, okay.
entering seventh grade, so starting middle school.
Oh,
And I do consider this my home, basically.
Sure.
Yes, and after high school, I did some moving around after I got my RN and actually lived in Florida for 3 years, where I went to graduate school to be a nurse practitioner
Yeah.
while working in the NICU at Mount Sinai down there.
Oh,
So,
okay.
yeah, so I've been around a
All
little
right.
bit, did a
You've
short
got
stint. Pardon? Go ahead.
quite a caring, a professional caring a career. And so I don't I'm it seems to resonate and ring true when here all these many years later, you're so concerned about the conditions of habitat and the care that we need to provide as we go forward stewarding these very delicate species.
Yep, and I do hope to share some more information.
Yeah,
I know
please do.
you have a good understanding of why this avian population is so important, but I don't know if everybody does, and I do want to touch on that a little bit farther into our
Yeah,
interview.
so very good. So would you go on and talk to us more about the article that you wrote, Flying Animals Deserve to Be Safe Over Lake Erie.
Okay. Well, you know, I think it's obvious at this point that I really became passionate about all of this, about preserving and protecting the environment and our lakes and our oceans and everything that flies over it and everything with fur and everything else that's alive that's not human that requires the waters of these lakes. And bringing awareness. You know, there's so much human destruction going on because of our own activities, and it seems to be without regard for the wildlife that are at our mercy, basically. And that's pretty much what led me to my other passion, which eventually turned into opposing the manufacturing, the transport and construction, and the ongoing devastation caused by these wind turbines, and we'll be talking more about that. But there's a lot of that that dates back a few years here when we were first introduced to the possibility of offshore wind in Lake Ontario. And that was, I believe, in 2009.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I learned from that, I know that you have asked me what I think people need to know.
Yes.
I think that the most important thing that I hope people will take away from this is never take an issue at face value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to listen to all sides, but then we need to do our own investigation. We need to educate ourselves. We need to read between the lines and question the motivation of the salesman. And don't be fooled, you know.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
That, to me, was the most eye-opening thing. I guess it was in 2009. I, living on the lake and also caring about the wildlife, learned that the New York Power Authority, or what we'll call NYPA, had introduced a potential offshore wind, what they call farm. It's not a farm. In either Lake Ontario or in the New York waters of Lake Erie. And I knew nothing about it back then. I just knew that I loved the lakes and that I wanted the earth to be clean and green. And so I initially thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And a week or two later, I found this flyer in my paper box talking about all the negatives and in particular what would happen to the flying animals, the avian slaughter that's been going on around the world, but also the pollution and the economic negatives. So I started doing my own investigation. And I was really surprised when I started reading real data, and it confirmed everything that was in that flyer, and worse. And if you hear barking, that's because my little dog is barking. But
may I just interject here? So
sure.
So you had the idea that you wanted to learn more about the facts and what was actually going on. What business dealings were going on, and perhaps the government might be involved and. For permitting and regulations and things like that. So anyway, so my question has to do with, as a citizen at that point, how did you know where to get started?
Where did you start? That was made so easy for me.
Tell us how you did it so that others uncover other things that they may be just interested in or curious about, and they want to know how all of that works. Tell us how that worked for you so that others can do that too.
Well, for me, it was pretty easy because back in 2009, there wasn't a lot of well-known or easily accessible information. But this particular – and there is now, and I can tell you how to access that. But back then, there wasn't. So when the flyer came around, there were several names and phone numbers on it.
Uh-huh.
So I called them, and I hooked up with people from New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Canada, and we started meeting. We'd meet in Youngstown. We met in a place called New Thane, which is west of here, headed toward Niagara Falls, so that we were more centrally located. We would drive all that way and get together and meet. And we formed, and that was 2009, and we formed Great Lakes Wind Truth. And we're still together, and we still have this commitment to protecting the Great Lakes, their avian residents, their migrants, their shoreline and watershed homeowners, everybody who drinks water from the lakes, basically. And now, all these years later, we have a Facebook page, we have a website, Great Lakes Wind Truth. People can go on there. But there's many of them now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's easy to find. And even when you go on those websites, ours is a very factual and honest one. I don't know if they all are. People still have to read between the lines, do their own homework, even after they read our information. I don't want people to just believe me. I want people to do the work of educating themselves, learning the truth. But that's what we, Great Lakes Wind Truth, that's basically what we do.
So I'm just getting at a little bit more when you started digging in to locate facts and documentation. How did you do that? Did you go to the local city office, or in 2009, you would have been able to go online. Where did you go to get factual documentation?
The first thing we did was go to the New York Power Authority, the people that were proposing to do this. And we actually invited them to some of our presentations and meetings, and it became so evident to us that there was a lot of self-serving stuff going on. So we started then researching online more information about how the turbines were made, where they were made, what the negative impacts were, and it's easy to find with an online search. I have a database of information and sites that I share with people, and the information it's negatively staggering. So that's what we did. We did this online search, and then we started vetting the people that had published this information and found out that, 99% of it was so legitimate. But it was so new here in this country that we were doing more of our research in Europe and Scandinavia, Germany, England, Scotland, Denmark. So, yes, we did a worldwide search to find out what the motivation was and what the downside of this whole industry is. And again, it's becoming well-known all over the world now anyway.
Sure, sure. Then, again, in those early stages of searching for information, then what other prospective partners or agencies, how did you identify those, like government agencies, whether they're federal, state, or local? Where did you start to find information?
Well, what you do is look at each project proposal. And you can do that online. They all have websites. And then you find out by reading those what the funding is. And you'll find in this country that almost all of it is federally funded through the U.S. Department of Energy. And they have cases where you can go in and investigate all of the filings. There in Ohio, we started, once we started working on the project there in Cleveland, we went on the Ohio Power Siting Board, and we read the application, and we started reading all of the input from Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Army Corps of Engineers, the Division of Natural Resources in Ohio, and most of it was scathing to the degree that in 2014, the application was by LECO was basically withdrawn from the Ohio Power Siting Board. And I've sent you plenty of information about that. The letters from the ODNR, from the Fish and Wildlife.
We'll include them in your article that will accompany this discussion.
Great.
Yes, and I have one other question, too. Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, in the early portion, early segment, the early years that you were involved in this. What kind of citizen engagement or citizen feedback or forums out above and beyond your own meetings, or maybe so? What was going on, and then how has the level of citizen engagement changed between the early years and now?
Mm-hmm. Well, back then, you know, as I said, I back in 2009 really didn't know anything about the wind industry, and so once we came together as Great Lakes Wind Truth, and we needed to have a pretty comprehensive plan for educating people, because that's what we do. We eventually were able to, through contacts with every single county on the south shore of Lake Ontario, starting up in Jefferson County at the St. Lawrence River, all the way west to Niagara and Erie counties on the west end, we were eventually invited to address every single county legislature except one, and eventually every one of them except one actually introduced a no resolution from their county to having turbines in Lake Ontario.
What does that mean specifically?
It meant that they would not allow any access from their county, via roads or tributaries or anything, into the lake to be able to construct these things. They would not support it, etc. I mean, that was huge. And many, many towns invited us to their town board meetings across the South Shore of Lake Ontario. We did presentations. We approached Rotary clubs, Kiwanis clubs, a couple of political groups. You name it. Anywhere we could find a group that would allow us to come and do a presentation, we did it. We did neighborhood associations. It was enormous. And we were extremely well received. When people would look at the data, would look at the research, they were horrified. And so it became a very, very comprehensive and well received effort here. And we did this for 2 years.
Okay. And what years were those? I'm just trying to get everything in context and in some kind of timeline so I can understand.
The New York Power Authority announced their intention to construct this thing on Earth Day of 2009. And they actually withdrew it 2 years later, September of 2011. And when they withdrew their proposal, they cited cost. But in the same context, they publicly called us out as Neanderthals. So we knew that we had a major impact on this. And, in fact, there was an editorial in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle back then about how inappropriate it was for them to be name-calling a group of people who were out there trying to educate their communities. So we were pretty proud about that. But as soon as I withdrew that, we became aware of the LEEDCO project being proposed for Lake Erie, so we didn't rest for more than an hour, and then we moved on to Lake Erie. So that's where we've continued to work since 2014, well, 2011, basically, when NYPA was, when they withdrew. Yep, 2011 we started opposing this project.
So tell me again the name of the group and now how many members or what kind of network does it look like now?
Okay, well, Great Lakes Wind Truth. And, you know, we're not incorporated. We're not a tax-paying group. We're a loosely put-together group. And there's always some flux in and out of the organization. Honestly, I'd have to look at the website to see how many people identify with us, and I haven't done that in the last couple of days. But we can do that. That's easy enough to do. We're also part of a much larger organization called North American Platform Against Wind, and that includes all of Canada and the United States, and even I believe there's some affiliation in Mexico. So we are a North American organization. We're part of a North American organization as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a huge number.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We'll find out. I'd be curious to know what kinds of audiences are involved. I'm sure there are many.
Yes.
I have another question for you. During this time, I heard little bits. It sounds as if local newspapers and some of the city newspapers picked up, I'm sure, coverage and reporting of, I would say, probably the meetings and the issues involved and mm-hmm. coverage of the different people involved and the businesses and organizations. Over the last years that you've been engaged in this, has the issue been well reported in higher level national magazines or newspapers? And how is your coverage going now with, say, some of the large publishing platforms like EcoWatch? Are they continuing to cover and report on what's going on?
I would have to say that there is not great coverage, and in part because that is Lake Erie. It's far away from most of us. And there's also a very strong and large group of people in the Cuyahoga County area who support the project. And so it's been very difficult to get coverage for this particular project. I'll be very honest. We haven't been terribly successful out there, and it's one of the reasons that, you know, we try to address things on a higher level. But there isn't a lot of, for some reason, there isn't a lot of input or major interest outside of the Cleveland area for, you know, publicizing this. And that's pretty sad for me and for all of the people in Great Lakes Wind Truth. For one thing, you know, the people that are proposing to build this thing, they're powerful. They have a lot of money. They now have a Norwegian backer who came over here. He's a multi-billionaire. And he's
that's who you refer to in the opening of your article. Could you go into the, so I see here, Lake Erie Energy Development Company, and this is from the opening of your article, LEEDCO mm-hmm. has been proposing to do, to install the construction of an industrial wind energy facility in the waters of Lake Erie since 2011, and has now partnered with Fred Olsen, a wealthy wind developer from Norway. Could you talk to us more about specifically about the project and what it's called so that people can get a real grasp of the parameters of it?
Yes. This is a plan that LEEDCO partnered with Fred Olsen for financial reasons. And it used to be, when it was just a LEEDCO project, which was then withdrawn from the Ohio Power Siting Board,
And when was that done about?
April of 2014.
Thank you.
Okay. And at that time, it was a nonprofit. And then last year, well, in 2016, I think, Fred Olsen came into the picture. And it suddenly changed its name, the name of the project, and it became a for-profit plan. So now it's out there to make money, which I find very interesting since it's our tax dollars that are financing over $40 million of it. So I'm contributing as a taxpayer, but the money could easily go to Fred Olsen. But I'd like to talk more about this project, as you said. It is proposed as a 6-turbine project out about 7 miles into 7 to 8 miles into the lake on, into Lake Erie, off the coast of Cuyahoga County. And I want to give you some background before, if I may, before
sure, please do.
I talk. Okay. Before I actually go into the description more of this proposal, I want to talk a little bit, if I can, about some information that people, because I'm trying to educate people. The first thing I want people to know is that Lake Erie is protected under the public trust doctrine. I don't know how familiar you are with the public trust doctrine.
No, tell me about it, please.
Well, it's a federal law that designates the Great Lakes, the Great Lake areas, the beds of the lakes, to care and trust of the states that border on them. And in Ohio, it says, it is a title held in trust, this is a quote, it is a title held in trust of the people of the state, that they may enjoy the navigation of the waters, carry on commerce over them, and have liberty of fishing therein, freed from the obstruction or interference of private parties. Well, the Icebreaker Project, Betsy, is now a private party. It's owned by Fred Olson, and it's for-profit.
Well, you bring up a good point of for-profit.
Sure. Well, not only is it now invading the lake that is held in trust for the public, but
yes,
now it's also held by a private entity that's out there to make money in our Great Lake. Okay?
Yes.
And because we have not had a lot of information yet on the project before, I want to talk a lot about the birds, but I will tell you that this project is projected to put initially, 6 turbines in the lake. Okay.
Six turbines.
Initially.
Mm-hmm.
Each one is it's 479 feet out of the water. Each one has a blade length, the 3 blades on each one, and each one has a 206-foot fiberglass blade, 3 of them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Each one has 404 gallons of oil in them. And we're going to talk more about that, okay? There's so much to talk about that I'm going to try and squeeze some stuff in. But first, I want to talk about the birds, if I may.
Please do.
Okay. You know, my interest in this, as I said before, became intertwined when I realized that our Great Lakes and our birds were both at risk. So back in 2011, and I'm pretty sure I had this in the article, I talked about the fact that the entire central basin of Lake Erie is a designated globally important bird area, both by your National Audubon Society and Bird Conservation International. And I always revert back when I started doing my self-education in 2011 of Lake Erie.
Yeah.
I always go back to the information from Jeff Schmidt back in March of 2011 when he was the chapter director for the Pennsylvania Sierra Club. All right, and he testified to the Pennsylvania State Legislature then regarding the placement of wind turbines in Lake Erie. So I found that information on the internet, and he testified, and this is a quote, "Lake Erie is unique among the Great Lakes because its shallow depth provides forage grounds for ducks, loons, horned grebes, and other waterfowl across its entire surface. Shorebirds, songbirds, and raptors all cross Lake Erie at varying altitudes and locations. Migratory birds are already stressed." And then he went on to say that, quote, "Lake Erie is unique in that its shallow depth provides potential habitat for pelagic birds across most of the lake's surface. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's huge, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that is what first opened my eyes to this. So then I started looking into different groups and that also were looking at the bird population and how it would be impacted. And as I put in the article back in that original application to the Ohio Power Siting Board, there was a lot of negativity from the Fish and Wildlife Service. In fact, they stated, and this is a quote from them, that the waters around Cleveland provide overwintering habitat for gulls, and they went on to name the gulls, and ducks, they went on to name all the ducks, common loons and horned grebes. During winter, flocks of over 10,000 birds are not uncommon. And they also went on to say that when the Icebreaker Project, which was LEADCO back then, submitted their information, they cited European offshore wind energy, not ours, because there wasn't any to cite. But they failed, mm-hmm. but LEADCO failed to mention that several European countries banned offshore wind facilities within 12 miles of their shoreline, primarily because it was due to the congregation of waterfowl near to the shore. So in Europe, most countries they forbid building within 12 miles of shore. And yet the Icebreaker is proposed for 7 miles out on a lake where they cross the lake at every altitude and every area. So yes, that became really scary for all of us that realized the slaughter that would occur. And then the Fish and Wildlife stated that based on LEADCO's own assessment of the number of migrants that would be flying at the height of the turbine blades, the Fish and Wildlife Service went on to say, quote, based upon these numbers, it would mean that between 400,000 to 13 million songbirds fly at the height of these rotors when flying over Lake Erie.
Up to and that's over million. The course of a year? Or,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, thank you for that. And then, can I ask you where the quotes are from?
Sure.
These are from documentation.
I have sent you those letters. I'm sure.
Thank you. From yes. Can you? Yeah. Tell us.
From the Fish and Wildlife Service, primarily.
All right. And then, and they are to you, or your organization.
So they're to the Ohio Power Siting Board.
Thank you. For the clarification.
The problem is, yes, and the problem is that since LEADCO withdrew their first proposal, all of that
yes.
information's been taken down and it's not accessible anymore. I am so grateful that I printed it all before that
yes.
was taken down.
Mm-hmm.
So we have it, and I did send it to you. And in that letter, they also noted that different, and this isn't a quote, this is just paraphrasing, but that different
sure.
alien species don't follow the same path every year. So
yes.
even if LEADCO or Icebreaker did a 1 or 2 year study, and by the way, they haven't done any, different species do not follow the same path every year. High and low air pressures, temperatures, wind speed and direction, these all impact migratory routes.
Yes,
this changes
there are many variables.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
and they
I
can't
understand.
Be predicted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that became extremely important as we were looking at, you know, as I was looking, all of us were looking at this avian information. But then, right there in Ohio, the Black Swamp Bird Observatory, Kim Kaufman, I believe, is the president or CEO,
yes.
whatever the leadership is, and the American Bird Conservancy came together, and they submitted a letter to the Ohio Power Siting Board. I have a copy of it, but it's also on the Ohio Power Siting Board website. You can find it there.
Okay.
And they came together and wrote a letter rejecting this project.
And when was that?
That, I believe, was a year ago.
Okay.
I know it was published in a newspaper called the Port Clinton News Herald back in November, but the letter was written long before that.
Oh, very
and
good.
They rejected the icebreaker claims that the wind facility would have little or no impact on birds and bats. They went on to say that, and this is a quote, it's from Kim Kaufman, the director, "In fact, having conducted more than 30 years of migratory bird research along Lake Erie, we believe the 6-turbine icebreaker project would pose a significant threat to wildlife." Okay? And that's just those six, but we're going to need to get into the change from 6 in a few minutes. The other thing is that LEADCO's assessment, and Kim Kaufman put this in the letter that she submitted, the assessment by LEADCO cites outdated studies, ignores new data from birds fitted with radio transmitters, and it showed that the species uses airspace central Lake Erie almost exclusively for its fall migration. LEADCO is not giving accurate information. And even though, and this also can be found on the Ohio Power Siting Board website, a letter from a legal group, John Stock of Benesch Attorneys. This is from a document that I printed from the Power Siting Board website. Despite the fact that Fish and Wildlife Service has been telling LEADCO Icebreaker for years that it must conduct valid radar studies for the proposed project site not from onshore, to date, the applicant has not conducted studies and provided data to the board. I mean, they haven't done it because there isn't anything that they can submit that's going to support that this is not going to kill millions, 13 million possibly, birds once they put these up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and now for the punchline.
Yes.
The punchline is that this project of 6 turbines is not their goal. Okay, Fred Olson's goal and LEADCO's is, quote, and this is a quote from their proposal, "a demonstration project to assess the potential success for future larger scale offshore wind farms and Lake Erie and the other Great Lakes," unquote. They're proposing, Betsy, that over the next 10 to 15 years, they will be able to put up 1,450 turbines in Lake Erie and the Great Lakes. This will become a killing field of unparalleled magnitude. And by the way, that's while still running and maintaining all of your coal plants, because you can't shut them down. Wind doesn't supply energy much of the time. So now you're polluting with coal and you're destroying the Great Lakes and killing everything that flies over it. Because in fact, not one single coal plant anywhere in the world has been shut down successfully where wind projects have been erected. You can't shut them down. The wind doesn't blow when you want it to blow. And you can't store the power. In fact, in Germany, it's a little bit of an aside, but in Germany, they're in the process, because they were such wind lovers and put up these wind farms all over the country that have caused the country to practically go bankrupt, by the way, they're in the process of building 11 new coal plants, because people need to have electricity and heat.
All right. Now, is there any connection between the proximity? I'm just asking between the proximity of wind turbines and coal plants, or are you just mentioning that as a related climate?
I'm mentioning it for several reasons. One, because wind turbines do not operate alone. And I'll talk a little bit about that, as I already have, but I can give you more specific information. But also because, you know, they tell people that this is so clean and green and it's going to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which it can't. It hasn't done that anywhere in the world where wind farms have been erected. And there in Ohio, I believe I read 59%, 59-point-something percent of your power comes from coal. Now, think about the fact that while you're getting almost 60% of your power from coal, that's not going away. In fact, when you try to adjust the amount of production from your conventional source, and in your case, 60% of it, essentially coal, when you try to adjust that to accommodate wind, instead of running the coal plant at a steady rate like you're doing, you ramp it up and down depending on how much wind you have. So if you're getting
they're interconnected. It's all part of the grid.
It's all part of the grid. The power goes into the grid, and when the wind isn't blowing, the coal plants ramp up, and that ramping up and down has been compared. And this is a very legitimate analogy. It's compared to driving your car. When you're on the interstate and you have speed control on, you're not braking and accelerating, and so you're putting out less emission than you are in the inner city when you're braking, accelerating. Do you understand that? That's simple.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. I mean, look at Los Angeles. Look at China, Beijing, places where they're so smogged in because of the number of cars. But you get out on the open highway and it's pretty clear. Well, the same thing happens with your coal plants. That ramping up and down has been shown to increase your greenhouse gas emissions. So you're not reducing carbon dioxide emissions anywhere by using wind. The data's out there. I mean, it's scary. And people are believing that this is a green answer. It's not.
I see. Well, it seems to be a complicated issue with several different factors operating in a system, and the consequences of how that system ebbs and flows or accelerates and decelerates has real consequential effects on the local environment.
Yes.
And all right, very good. Well, thank you for explaining that.
Well, there's so much more to it. Do I have time to explain a couple more things?
Please do.
Okay, great. So we've talked about the birds. We've talked about some of the problems with requiring backup. I want to talk a little bit about the issue related to the goal, which is not these six turbines, the goal being 1,450 of them. And once you open the barn door, it's pretty darn hard to close it. But this demonstration project is not needed. These six turbines aren't going to really add anything much to your grid, okay? And they know that. That's why their goal is to put 1,450 of them out there. Well, if you look at the requirements for your siting board in Ohio, it says that they're not going to – I have the requirements in front of me, and it says that the board should not grant a certificate for the construction, operation, and maintenance of a major utility facility unless it meets these following criteria. One of them says that the facility represents the minimum adverse environmental impact. Well, we know that that's not going to happen. I don't know how they could even allow this project to be to move forward with a certificate, okay, because it's not going to represent a minimal adverse environmental impact. It also goes on to say that one of the criteria, the sixth one, is that it serves the public interest and necessity. Those six turbines aren't necessary, and they sure as heck don't represent public interest. So I don't even know how these six things can be approved. They say that, you know, this is environmental compatibility needs to be there. It's not compatible with the environment. We know that, okay? I mean,
I have a question for you. What is the reason for the attraction to install wind turbines on the lakes? What's the reason for that?
Well,
I mean, is there must be an advantage? But what is the advantage? Is there?
They say that it's windier.
Topographical, or what?
Windier. It's windier. They can capture more wind.
Oh, because of the open surface of the water and the various temperature effects and depth and things. I see.
Nor'easters.
Okay.
And however the other side of that is, when we have one of those nor'easters, you don't want to be within a mile or more of those blades, because when those things start spinning out of control, as we've seen worldwide, I have many videos of them doing this, they explode.
I see.
Yes, and those fiberglass blades explode into parts that can fly over a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have the videos. It can't be debated. There's a physics professor at Cornell University. His name is Jack Sullivan. And he's written some articles about it. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that even he, and everybody knows this, I mean, it's published everywhere, but even he has said, and this is a quote from him, wind power can never supply a steady baseload power, nor can it supply reliable and predictable electricity in any amount, which we know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to hear that from a physics professor at Cornell. Okay?
Yes.
And that's why I have said to you that your 60% of power is always going to be maintained and running. So you're going to be paying twice. You're going to be paying both for the wind and for coal and nuclear, natural gas, whatever else you have that contributes to your electric grid.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an add-on, an unreliable, unpredictable add-on, and a dangerous one, and one that's going to destroy the lakes. So, you know, in fact, if you look over at Canada, back in I guess it was in March of 2016, there was an article in Forbes, and that's pretty respected. It was authored by a man named Jude Clement, and he talked about the high energy prices in Ontario. And he says, quote, for example, more expensive wind has provided less than 4% of Ontario's power, but accounts for 20% of the cost of electricity. And by the way, that's had a really negative impact on manufacturing, because when people can't afford the electric bills, the manufacturers move somewhere else. So this, you know, information about jobs is not really legitimate, okay, permanent jobs. And in fact, Block Island, our first offshore wind project in the United States, all the jobs that they taunted, well, of course, the icebreaker is saying that they're going to have 525 jobs. That was back in 2014. Now they're saying more. But the Block Island...
Those jobs that are for construction, or are they long-term, installation jobs?
They taunted that. 525 jobs, I'm looking at the flyer, of construction, installation, and operations. So they don't tell you. But if you look at Block Island, they had 300 temporary construction jobs. Do you want to know how many permanent jobs resulted from that multi-million dollar project that we paid for?
How many?
Seven.
Okay. All right. Oh, so that gives a good case example of the workforce impact and the sustainability of the workforce, the proposed workforce development.
Correct.
And whether or not, and the numbers that are involved.
Yes. And when you look at the numbers involved, the Cleveland Public Power, which is your public power company,
yes,
they have agreed to pay a price not to exceed $181.57 for each megawatt hour during the first year of operation, $181.57, okay? Now, that factors in backup. But do you want to know what they're paying without wind? $33 a megawatt hour. So this is contract. So your CPP organization there, your Cleveland Public Power, would be contracting for, I figured, 550% of the current market rates. Do you want your rates adjusted that way?
Right, right.
Who can
all of
that?
these different actions have reactions and have an effect, consequential effects that it's hard for people to grasp when they're not informed, they're not educated, or they haven't been around this information and these activities, such as yourself and all of the different people that you're connected to.
Correct. So if they're going to be contracting to increase what they pay for electricity by 550%, how many businesses go out of business or move? How many people can't afford power anymore? What does this do for
right.
jobs? It become a ghost town, literally.
Well, the consequences of these extenuating circumstances have a huge impact on
correct.
And none of those are the hardest ones, of course, to forecast because you have no idea of the different variables that are involved and how things will unfold and play out. So tell us some more. What else would you like?
What else would you
like us to know?
I know we're getting toward the end of our time, so there are a couple things that I do just want to share. I mean, I know I've given you a lot of data. And
yes.
that's really important.
It is.
You know, because that's the educational part of it. But I want
right.
I want to just add some things that I want people to think about.
Sure, thank
okay.
you.
In Ohio alone, approximately 11 million people drink from your lake. 11 million. Now, think about it. If you
Well, the Great Lakes are our world's largest aggregated source of fresh water.
That's correct. And
right.
they want to
mm-hmm.
pollute it with 1,450 of these turbines that each one can contain 404 gallons of oil. That
mm-hmm.
amounts to almost 586,000 gallons of this oily fluid sitting over our drinking water.
Yes.
Some perspective on that is that already in Hawaii and California, we have over 14,000 of these turbines that have aged out, that have rusted, burned, exploded, that the owners have walked away from because they can't afford to decommission them. And how do you decommission those ones out in the lake that have already spilled their 404 gallons each into our drinking water? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
586,000 gallons of oil sitting in those lakes if you put those 1,450 turbines out there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that people in Ohio want to take responsibility for? I have to say absolutely no. Is it worth destroying our lakes and killing all of these flying animals for something
sure. right.
of this magnitude?
Mm-hmm.
you know? And there are so many other things about this that are filthy. You know, the manufacturing, the fiberglass blades. What do you do with them when they start to wear out? They don't have a life expectancy offshore of 20 years. You're going to still be, we are still going to be paying for them long after those things are no longer working, or they've, you know, blown up or exploded or just rotting in our lakes. We're still going to be paying for them.
Right. I was thinking, you know, perhaps we could take a look at what is the percentage of turbines, you know, or the life expectancy of, let's say, of the three blades or one of those three blades on any given turbine. But you can't do that, because even today we have the increase in frequency of peaks in weather, the extremes of weather.
Correct.
So, and we don't even, that's a whole new frontier for this planet because of man's effects on the planet. So we have these more and more severe storms. We have these huge variations in extreme weather, and so we can't even predict any kind of it would seem with any knowledge of the timeline of lifeline of just one turbine. Wait.
And that brings up a question that you asked me initially when you sent the interview questions, and you asked me what I thought about the future. What do you see for the future is what you asked me.
Yes.
I've given that a lot of thought since you sent that. And that's a really tough question, Betsy. And
It's simple but very hard.
It's very complex, because you just mentioned one of the main reasons. And who really knows, you know?
Right.
The other main reason is human activity.
Yes.
At the rate we're clearing forests, at the rate we're polluting the oceans and millions of tons of garbage daily from all around the world, at the rate that we're dumping all these chemicals into our watershed regions, like pesticides, fertilizers, chemicals from industry, all that stuff ends up in our fresh water source, the Great Lakes.
Okay? Right.
All of these things sicken and kill wildlife, and again, who really knows how much longer the Earth will be able to sustain life? I don't know what the future is, but I'll tell you that I find it very scary. And that's the main reason, going back to our birds here, that's the main reason that we do our migratory raptor counting every year. Raptors are indicator species. Okay? Large numbers of them indicate a healthier ecosystem. But a sharp reduction in them one year or multiple years, or a decline over years, a trend, indicates a problem in our ecosystem and our environment, something that we need to investigate further, something we need to pay attention to. Nature's trying to tell us something. And honestly, Leadco, Olson, anybody else who proposes to put these things up in our lakes, they can spin this any way they want. But that contributes to our fear for what's happening to our future, fresh water, wildlife. I'm very concerned for our future. And that, and these turbines are in our lakes in particular, are part of the problem. So, I mean, there's so much more. I could go on for two more hours.
Well, you've given us a good introduction to some of the components of wind turbines in the lakes and that issue, and some of the extenuating circumstances and the background and history of who is involved and how it started, and the citizen response, and also several key points pivoted the nature of the issue, such as beginning as a nonprofit enterprise or entity, I should say, and then shifting the lead coach project shifting to a for-profit. And that's a game changer.
And none of our organizations make a nickel. We're not paid by anybody.
But I understand they're for the greater public good. Let me ask you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we have done so much work to try and preserve these Great Lakes that even though we helped to defeat in 2011 the project from the Power Authority here in New York, when we came on board in 2014, well, much earlier than that actually, just in 2011 to start fighting your project in Lake Erie, with the work that we did, and this was a great honor, okay? And it just proves, in my own opinion, our altruistic reasons for doing this. We were deemed by the Erie County, New York legislature. Erie County borders on Lake Erie, but it's in New York State. They named several of us from Great Lakes Wind Truth stewards of the Great Lakes. And the county legislature actually sent us these certificates individually. Mine is framed sitting on my desk. That was an honor for each of us. You know,
Well,
it was recognition.
Thank you for all your...
Thank you. What we're doing is not for our own personal gain, but for the good of all. And I guess that's all I have time for.
Well, thank you so much for making the time today to begin to help us to understand this complex issue so that people can be educated and informed about it and also learn where they might go to learn more themselves. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you. You mentioned that you have a list. Am I right? Could you supply a list of, say, organizations that our readers could contact
for
next steps or to become engaged?
Yes.
And we'll add it to the article.
Mm-hmm. I would be happy
do
that. I will send you an email today.
Very good. Well, I hope we can talk again in the future, maybe about the next chapter.
Okay.
And you can continue to help us become informed and educated on this issue and
keep us
apprised of what's going on. So
I am very grateful
so
for
much.
This opportunity. Thank you, Betsy.
Oh, well, thank you, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Suzanne Albright, talking about flying animals deserve to be safe over Lake Erie. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.